You might have noticed that Pat and I are pretty fussy about our finances and our investments.
Yeah, a lot of junk doesn't make it past our bullshit detectors. But one thing that we've both used for many years is ShareSite. It records all dividends, franking credits, transactions, and performance easily in one place.
You can generate reports for income and capital gains, which makes tax time super easy. And ShareSite is completely free if you have 10 holdings or less.
So we've partnered with ShareSite to help support the podcast and provide all our listeners who upgrade to a paid plan a saving of 33% off the annual plan price. If you start with a free plan using our link, you'll still get that discount if you upgrade to a paid plan in the first 60 days.
Just head to ShareSite.com/fire and chill to get started.
Welcome to the Fire and Chill podcast, a collaboration between Dave from Strong Money Australia and Pat from Lifelong Shuffle, where we're going to have regular conversations about fire, investing, and living your best life. Okay, welcome back everybody to the Fire and Chill podcast. In episode 2, we talked about how important saving is to your fire journey, but in this episode, we really wanted to hammer this point home. Today, we're going to talk about the savings rate. We're going to talk about the effects of the saving rate on your fire journey and why it matters more than anything else. I think for Dave and I, this is something we're both really passionate about. Both of our blogs really focus more on savings and psychology of savings instead of sort of get rich quick or save, you know, a few coins here and there, couponing or something, or it's not really focused too much on earning more or side hustles. What we really like to hammer down in is how do you have the most efficient and enjoyable lifestyle possible? And part of that is the savings rate. So what do you think, Dave? Do you agree?
Yeah, man, as you know, I totally agree. Like, as we're going to go into today, it's just the number one factor when it comes to retiring early. And like, I can honestly say that for my partner and I, we're retiring today really because of our savings rate, not because of our investments. Like, investing is important too, and we'll get into that. But looking back, our investments, especially as of this year, like, our investments overall over the last, I guess, decade or so have been like almost pretty average when looked at in the grand scheme of things. But it's really that consistent saving month after month and having a high savings rate for like a long period of time is really what enabled us to retire early more than anything else.
For me, I have a high income, so people say that it's pretty easy for me to save a lot of money. I'm so glad to have you on this podcast, because every time someone comes in with that like little sucker blow, they're like, oh, it's easy for you. You earn a lot. And I'm like, shut up. Look at Dave. Like, he did this without earning an obscene amount of money. And he's proof that it can be done on a typically average Australian salary. Thanks for that, Dave. Your presence is most welcome here.
But I guess like we'll go into, there's two parts to increasing your savings rate. Obviously, there's two inputs. There's what's coming in and what's going out. So we can look at increasing our savings rate in two ways. Where spending less is obviously one option, but then earning more is also another option. And that's debated quite regularly on which is the more effective route to take, which is the more enjoyable route to take, and all the rest of it. So we'll look at both of those today.
So let's crack straight into it. We've got the first factor, which we want to talk about, which is spending less. Spending less means you don't need to save as much, right? Because every time you reduce your lifestyle expenses, the amount of money you need to support a lifestyle of that type decreases, and it decreases by a huge amount, because going by typical retirement rule of thumb, you need about 25 times your yearly expenses to be financially independent. So every time you can reduce your spending by, say, $1,000 a year, that means that you need $25,000 less in your savings or your investments to be able to retire early.
That's the thing. So it's effectively like, if you can reduce those costs by $1,000, it's almost like the bloody tooth fairy has just chucked an extra 25 grand on top of your portfolio, because it's effectively the same outcome.
Yeah, exactly. And so you could obviously go out and earn all that extra money and try and save it and invest it, and that's certainly an option. But if you can just you know, do without something, or you find that there's some sort of money you're spending that isn't really important for you to be happy in your life, and you're just sort of spending it on autopilot, then getting rid of that brings you so much closer to being able to get financially independent.
And I guess some people will say, well, you can also go out and earn that extra $1,000. But remember, there's also, that's going to be extra work for most people. Mm. There's going to be more tax payable, so you'll have to maybe make an extra $2,000 to get the $1,000, depending on your tax rate, obviously. There's obviously more pressure involved. You still need upending that higher, I guess, investment balance to retire on later.
Yes.
So it's not quite as easy as it sounds.
No, certainly not. And spending less, you know, it continues to pay dividends, so to speak, in more ways than one. If you lower your yearly expenses, you don't only need to save a lower amount overall. Because you have lower ongoing expenses, you can reduce your emergency fund to cover yourself for whatever period of time you feel safe. So for example, let's say you have living expenses of $60,000 per year and you wanted 1 year in your emergency fund, and that's $60,000 you have to keep in your emergency fund doing nothing. But if you reduce your expenses to $50,000 per year, then you only need to keep $50,000 in your emergency fund, and you've unlocked another $10,000 to invest and earn money through time. So it helps you in yet another way.
I guess another way of putting it is the more cash that you leave, I guess, lying around in emergency funds, whether it's like necessary or not, creates a drag where your money could be invested and working harder than just sitting around in cash. That's not to say you shouldn't have an emergency fund, because look at like what's happening right now. A lot of people will be extremely thankful that they do have an emergency fund. They might not need all of it. Some other benefits might kick in, but they'll be feeling pretty good that they do have it. So job loss is often the biggest reason that they do need an emergency fund. So, or maybe a car replacement or a health event, but especially for times like now, they will be pretty happy that they do have some type of cash sitting around.
Let's just bring this more back down to earth. Would you mind sharing with us how much your yearly expenses are, or how much you have in an emergency fund?
Okay. So our yearly expenses as of last year were about $37,000 for the year, and that's including rent. Rent was about half of that, or thereabouts, a little bit more than half.
Yeah, back to our housing episode last week. Fucking housing takes up half of your expenses in Australia.
Yeah. So if you looked at that another way, it's still not that much. It's $400 a week, which is not a massive amount. Our emergency fund situation is a little bit unusual because, as you know, we're doing this transition thing from property to shares over time. So we actually have a lot of cash, more than I would like to have long term. So in terms of emergency fund, if I was on the journey still, I'd probably go for the bare minimum and whatever I can survive on if we were to lose a job for 3 months or something. Having said that, we were living on less than one of our wages. So if one of us lost our jobs, you wouldn't need to call on any of that emergency fund at all, because we're still living on less than one person's wage. So it's only for a super emergency where we both lost our jobs that we would actually need that cash. So I'd probably try and keep as little as possible, to be honest, and that'll look different for everyone.
Yeah, and I'm in a totally similar position. My yearly expenses with my partner average around $45,000 a year, I'd say. It fluctuates a little bit. As far as an emergency fund goes, like, I don't keep one at all. I keep an amount of cash to keep myself liquid. As you said, like, if one of us loses our job, we're fine. If we need to purchase, like, something big all of a sudden, I can't even imagine what that might be, a fridge or something, then that can be put on a credit card. It might not even need to be put on a credit card, because I save way more than a fridge would cost every paycheck.
That's the thing. Once there's like a few thousand dollars left over each month, there's not a big list of things that can, you know, that can outnumber that savings each month that you'll need more money for.
Yeah.
Except maybe, like, I don't know, a car replacement or whatever, but some people go car free. I don't know if you guys have a car.
Well, that's another thing where I'm probably just lucky and fortunate. My work covers the entirety of my car expenses. So it's a fully paid for, fully supplied car. If anything happens to it, they need to replace it. They need to fix it up. So that's another reason I don't need to have a particularly big emergency fund. And in fact, I'm right on the low end of the extreme. It's like, my expenses are so low and emergencies are so unimaginable in my case, because again, I have no kids, I have no mortgage or house, very low expenses, that I keep a $0 emergency fund. If, like, shit really hits the fan, Steph and I both lose our jobs and like we don't have a lot of money because we have no emergency fund, the first instance, our liquid cash will probably keep us going for a couple of weeks or a few weeks. I can call on credit lines to keep me going until one of us at least can find a new job. Again, worst comes to worst, we have all these investments sitting around which I can just sell little bits of to support ourselves. That's sort of a bet I'll say that I'm winning so far, because the amount of money that most people recommend to keep in an emergency fund, say 6 months. If I'd kept 6 months worth of expenses in emergency fund since I started investing, like I've already earned that much again on that money. Like money has doubled since I started investing. So everything from now on is just cream. I've got, or if I need to sell investments, then I'm still no worse off than if I did have an emergency fund. Definitely a totally different story if you have kids or you have a house you need to take care of and you need money just sitting around just waiting to be spent for little emergencies, because the emergencies come thick and fast when you have that sort of a lifestyle.
Yeah, good point. So let's kick into the next bit, which is savings, the number one thing that we have control of. So I guess as much as people sometimes don't like to hear it, we can control how much we save and how much we spend. That's not really a popular viewpoint, but that's the viewpoint I have anyway.
Wait, how, you know, it's so hard to make ends meet in Australia these days. You know, we've got, you know, soccer practice and piano recital and... We've got two four-wheel drives in the driveway, the insurance, the registration. How could I possibly save any money, Dave?
We could go down, we could be here for hours, man.
But jesting aside, I obviously agree. Saving is much more in people's control than how much they can earn. Like, how much you earn definitely is in your control, but it takes more time and effort to move up the earning scale, so to speak. But savings is immediately within your control. You can choose to lower your lifestyle expenses from today, from this week, and you can have an immediate effect. Whereas if you wanted to earn more, that's more of a medium-term goal. It's something you have to plan for, something you have to, you know, apply for jobs, upskill, gain more experience, that sort of thing. Savings, do it right now and you're well on your way.
I guess that's the thing, that where it's in our control, that if we save money today, it's there tomorrow. So it's like, it's guaranteed, and we can just repeat that process over and over again. So that's what I mean is, as it's controllable, you know, we can, it's a reliable way to build wealth in that sense.
Yeah. I mean, if you ask me, savings or spending less than you earn is the only reliable way to build wealth. When I say that, I mean, obviously you can start a small business, you can become really skilled and invest and do all that sort of stuff. But at the end of the day, you build wealth by not spending all the money you make. Whether it is you do start a business, whether you do win the lotto, whether you do get an inheritance, the only way you build wealth is by not spending all of that. When we say saving is the only reliable way to build wealth, I 100% mean that literally, by almost by definition, you build wealth by not spending money that comes in.
And it's, I guess it's controllable in the sense that, you know, we can sit here and say, you know, property gives you X return per year, shares will return X percent per annum over the long term, but maybe those are average long-term figures, but that almost never ever happens in any given year. It's always like, you know what I mean? It's up and down, and it's not reliable year to year. So you can save regularly every single month. Once you build that habit, the cash is going to build up, and I guess nothing's going to shake that progress.
That's right. Yeah. Once you get that snowball rolling on that savings snowball, it takes a lot of effort to knock that snowball off its course. And like you said, investments, notoriously unreliable. You know, long term, you could say they're reliable over 10, 20, 30 year timeframes, but year to year, terribly volatile, terribly unreliable. Even people's favorite investment, property, people think that goes up reliably. It always goes up. That's horse shit. Any individual property, this month you might have four buyers. In a year's time, you might put it up for sale and you just, for whatever reason, the buyers just aren't there, because it's what I'll call such an inefficient market. It's, you know, you might get lucky and have a bidding war on your property, or you might get unlucky and for whatever reason, just no one that's in the market at that point in time is interested in a property such as yours. So it really is as volatile as the share market, I'll say. Maybe I'm wrong there, but that's the way I feel anyway.
So let's get into some numbers and let's show a good example of how this works and why we're saying that saving's more reliable than investing. So clearly, the more money you save, the more you have to invest, and that speeds up the growth of your net worth. And as you said, Pat, gets that snowball rolling. But let's put some numbers to it. If you're not into numbers, maybe you can skip this section, but there's only a few, I promise. Let's say you have a monthly savings rate of $300 and you're tucking that into away into investments that are earning 7% per year. And we know that we said that that's bullshit, but it's an example, so we have to go with it, okay?
Yep.
That $300 a month will grow to about $52,000 in 10 years' time. So that's not too bad. But a weekly saving of $300 will grow to $225,000 in 10 years' time. Now we're actually getting somewhere. But out of that $225,000, how much do you reckon comes from saving and how much do you reckon comes from investing? Well, $156,000 of that comes from saving. Only $69,000 came from investment returns.
Yes.
That actually seems pretty surprising to me, Pat, even because it's a 10-year time frame. So you'd think that really, like, that snowball's rolling. Yeah. Surely the investments are going to start powering that powering that snowball. But it really didn't happen in this 10 years.
No.
That's pretty crazy, I reckon.
Yeah, really wild. That's sort of where we're getting at here. You need to get the savings down, Pat, and the investments will take over later. Later sometimes means, you know, not even 10 years. It might mean 15, 20, 30 years. So You need to build that nest egg first before you can really see the investments giving you as much as your savings can give you.
Mm. So let's look at a bigger example. We'll go with let's say a household earns 100K per year and saves 50K per year. So they're living on 50K per year. And again, they're investing that 50 grand and earning 7% per year. After 10 years, they'd have $750,000 of investments.
Nice.
And of this $750,000, how much do you reckon came from savings? It was actually $520,000. So 70% of their total net worth in 10 years came from just saving cash, not from investment returns. That's insane.
That is absolutely insane. So why do people bother with investments, Dave?
Well, that's probably what we're going to get into in the next one or two episodes, Pat, of why, like, we might be saying, like, all you need to do is save. And I hope we're not coming across like, you know, just save cash, don't worry about investing, because investing is super, super important. And we're going to definitely cover that very soon. But we just want to highlight and really hammer how much saving matters, especially with a 10-year time frame or even 15-year time frame, like, which might be a semi-standard financial independence journey.
Yeah, because we are talking about financial independence, we are talking about very condensed saving time frames with very high savings rates. So what that ultimately means is this happens. You end up saving more than the investments bring you over that condensed time frame. But as we'll see in the next episodes, it's over the rest of your life, the 20, 30, 40, 50 years, that's when the investments will more than pay you back for building that initial nest egg.
Yeah, exactly. So it might seem counterintuitive at first, but saving matters in the first 10 years, and that's when your investments really kick in later. But for financial independence purposes and retiring super early, saving is basically king.
Yeah, and I can definitely say that's as true for me as it is for anyone. I've been doing this for, I don't know the years properly now, but it's probably like 4 years or something, and the vast majority of my net wealth up till today has been from my savings, not from my investments returns. And just like you, I probably haven't done stellar with my investments over the last 4 years, but definitely still learning and investing better and better every year, and hopefully they really take the lead on this.
And don't you think there's a psychological effect to that too? Because the more you're relying on investment returns, as we said, those are largely unpredictable year to year. So the less control you feel you have over your situation. But if you're relying more on your savings that are continual and consistent every month, you feel like you have more control over your situation. You're making progress regardless of how your investments are performing. So I think there's a positive mental aspect to that as well. What do you reckon?
Yeah, I definitely think so. Like, when the market crashed in March this year and everyone was freaking out, there was something about continuing to invest, continuing to follow the plan that really brings a lot of, I don't know, calm to the situation. It's like, no, this is all part of the plan. Like, this was always going to happen at this exact point in time. When I started 3 years ago, even though I didn't know it, this crash was going to happen and I was going to save right through it. And when you think of it in that frame of mind, it's like, I'm no further behind where I was a month ago or 6 months ago, because this was always within the plan. As long as I'm continuing to save on a regular basis, which is what I'm doing, I'm always inching closer and closer on that path that was always going to be my savings path. Even though we think savings is king, how about earning more, Dave? Why should I bother, you know, scrimping and saving little bits and pieces there when I can just earn some extra money and then all of that savings doesn't matter?
Well, it's a good point, isn't it? I mean, people argue that there's a limit to saving, and that's undoubtedly true. I guess the main point to that is that there's no limit to your earning capacity, in theory at least.
Mm.
So let's run through some thoughts on that. It does sound great in theory that there is essentially no limit to what you can earn, but it's maybe not so. I mean, it sounds a little bit like a fantasy, but it's not so glamorous in practice, you know?
Well, I suppose it's hard to recognize in yourself, but you can always think that way, no matter how much you're earning at some point in time. It's like, well, why should I save when I can just earn more and save that extra money? But, you know, your lifestyle inevitably just increases to match whatever you're earning, and you still end up saving nothing.
I think if you're saving nothing while earning a decent income, more income is not the right approach. Because no. If you're not saving right now, why would you save with a higher income? You know, it's just, you're either saving or you're not, I think.
But it's so counterintuitive, because when you are living on, let's say you have a salary of, you know, $50,000 or $60,000 a year, it's intuitive to think, well, I'm living on $60,000 a year now. If I earned $80,000 per year, obviously I would have extra money and I could save that, but it never works out that way.
Yeah.
You know, you always find a way to spend that extra money, and then instead of, you know, then you're now spending $80,000 a year, and it's like, oh, if I only had $90,000 a year, then I could obviously save that extra $10,000.
I guess regardless of the situation, we all seem to find a way to justify our current lifestyle and why we shouldn't, or even to escalate it, and why we deserve more and why we deserve better things and all the rest of it. Yeah. Compared to, and we always, even myself, like, I guess we justify it and we don't want to downgrade our lifestyle. So that can be a tricky starting point. And it can be a little bit scary for people who think that they're going to be missing out and they're going to be less happy and all the rest of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So back to earning more, we definitely can earn more. And I did, as much as I'm talking about saving and almost talking down trying to earn more money, I did actually make a fairly concerted effort to earn more on my journey. I did plenty of overtime at my warehouse job. I was doing it fluctuated from year to year, but most years I would do a decent amount of overtime each week. And I turned a job that was earning maybe $70,000 at the start to like $80,000. And my peak was like 90 something. I did a very heavy overtime year, 1 year. So I did make a definite effort to make more money, because it did make a difference. But I hear, Pat, you do free overtime. don't get paid for your overtime.
Yeah, in my industry, it is actually getting better. So definitely when I started, it was very much expected that you just did a lot of free overtime. And it is still expected in certain circumstances. So if I were to come in to work on a Saturday because we needed to get some extra work done, then that's just pro bono. I just need to come in and get the extra work done.
Have you made an effort to earn more since you started this journey?
Yeah, 100% I have. I've, you know, chased down promotions, tried to work better, looked at moving jobs, doing all of those sort of things that salaried employees can do. Since I started, I've, increased my salary by really large amount, I'll say. Like, I'm earning more now than I thought I would ever earn in my career. And it's been actually quite a surprise to me. And I'm obviously very thankful for that. Yeah, I'll continue to sort of do my best to try and earn more, because I've still got a few years left at this. Yeah, so definitely not speaking down earning more at all. All we're saying is that earning more isn't going to solve all of your problems. You need to have a strong habit of saving for that extra earnings to actually make a difference to your life and to make a difference to your FIRE journey. So get the savings down, Pat, first. And then when you do actually earn more, those extra earnings will go into your savings instead of just disappearing into lifestyle inflation.
I think if we want to sum it up, we would probably say that trying to live on less and save more is more efficient than trying to earn more money. Both are a good idea, but we just think the saving route tends to be more efficient by spending less.
Yeah, more efficient, more reliable, and you need to have the savings down pat anyway before earning more will make a difference. So it makes more sense to focus on your savings to begin with, and then you can shift gears and focus on earning more.
Mm. People like to talk about side hustles. That's become a popular term in the last, I don't know, in the last 5 years or so. And they're great in theory, but they also take away from your free time right now. Most people that are on the FIRE journey, they're already working full time. So is a side hustle really the best option for them to increase their savings rate? I mean, they're already, like, I guess the principle behind FIRE is getting your life back and getting more free time and more freedom than you currently have. So is it worth sacrificing much more time now to work on a side hustle? Yeah. What do you think about that, Pat?
I've always sort of been of the opinion that it's not worth it for me. I can't really speak to other people's situations, but because I work Saturdays and I do work so many, not just Saturdays, sometimes, I'm sure you know, Dave, I'll work the whole weekend through. So I'll work Monday to Friday 1 week. I'll, you know, then work Saturday, Sunday and continue working Monday to Friday the next week. And I might get a day off like on Thursday or Friday of the second week. So the idea of doing a side hustle on top of that, yeah.
You'd just be a zombie.
I'm a zombie now sometimes, you know?
Maybe your side hustle could be you can play a zombie in a movie or something like that.
Yeah. Like you said, you used to do plenty of overtime, but a normal day at work for me is already 10 hours. So
yeah, same for me. It was the same for me, yeah.
And so it's like you get up, you go to work, you do 10 hours, you come home, you do your shopping, you do the cooking or whatever, or the cleaning, and then you sit down for a bit and you chill. And you could possibly do a side hustle in that time, but exactly how much energy do you have left on?
I guess it's not going to be a great option if you really enjoy your downtime or your work is super demanding or you have a family.
Well, I was going to say, I don't even have kids yet. I'm already exhausted when I get home.
I mean, if you're single and you have plenty of spare time after work and whatever, maybe that could be a decent option.
Yeah, perhaps.
Yeah, but I really think earning more only really has, I mean, it has most of its benefits while you're earning more. Like saving more and spending less has permanent benefits. Like you have a lower cost of living forever, essentially, by learning to live on less. And I find it less stressful and you have more free time. And like I said, I did try and earn more, but I find that living on less is more efficient, and it was a better use of my energy and my focus to try and lower our costs rather than to try and chase more money, because it did make me a lot more tired and it made my free time less enjoyable because I just didn't want to do anything, you know, I was just too tired. So I did a lot of overtime for a while, it didn't last forever because it's just not really sustainable.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think that's sort of what carries me through as well. I know it's not forever. If you were to ask me, oh, do you want to work Saturdays and Sundays and, or, you know, 10 hour days and you're going to do that for the next 10 or 15 or 20 years, I'd probably be like, you know what, I'll find another career because I don't want that lifestyle split. But because I know it's only short term, I can sort of be like, okay, whatever. I actually enjoy this job. I like the sort of work that it is. So I can put up with this short term while I save for this goal.
Like if you have enough time, a side hustle can be a good idea if it's something that you actually enjoy outside of work, because then you can even look at transitioning into that when you're closer towards the end of your journey. So you can kind of test the waters with little side projects and whatever here and there to see if you'd like to do that once you have reached financial independence.
Yeah, fair enough. And that could be a good idea if you genuinely enjoy it. Yeah. But if you are tiring yourself out to the point that it's affecting your main job, you're probably doing more harm than good. Again, I take this from the point of view of a salaried employee. You might take this different, but if you're a salaried employee and you're not performing at work and that means you miss out on a $5,000 promotion, is your side hustle really going to earn you an extra $5,000 per year? I don't know. Maybe it will. Maybe it won't. But then it compounds, because then you can get the next promotion and the next promotion. I feel like you should definitely focus on your career and building it and doing a really good job in your main career, because I think that's where you'll make the most gains. Tiring yourself out on a side hustle, not that it's always the wrong idea, but you know, keep your priorities straight and where you can earn the most money in the short term.
So having focus is important. I think that's a good point.
Yeah.
Just to cover, I mean, at the start of the show, you kind of mentioned, Pat, that I was not on a super high income.
Yeah.
But then later I just said, oh, I was earning $90,000. To me, it's a pretty high income. So I just want to explain that just before we go forward.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, yeah.
So I was just doing my job was, for those who don't know, was I was a forklift driver / storeman in a warehouse here in Perth. I mean, that kind of job for just a regular day shift would maybe earn, I guess, $50,000 a year or so. Maybe a little bit more, maybe $55,000. Because I switched to a job which had... There was night shift involved. There was like weekend work involved. There was public holiday work involved. It was still a 40-hour or so a week roster, but because of those other, you know, other benefits on top, that pushed the average wage to about 70 or so. And then obviously I did overtime, which pushed it up to 80 and then towards 90, depending on how much I eventually did. But that's to explain, yeah, how I turned a not such a high paying job into a better paying job.
And I find that's a common theme among what we typically consider to be high income earners, whether they be wage employees or salary employees. They're almost never, ever doing, you know, 9 to 5, 5 days a week. Every better paid employee that I've ever met, you know, making anything above 70, 80, 90,000. They're always doing far more than the typical, you know, standard work week. It's, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there are really high paid employees out there that aren't just doing the 7.5 hours per day for 5 days a week. Certainly there are, actually. I probably know a few, but I think it's a common theme that higher paid people do more hours just naturally.
All right, so let's talk about desires to spend and whether we can actually out earn our desire to spend. So high income earners they tend to be famous. Super high income earners especially tend to be famous for having lifestyle tastes that either meet or exceed their high incomes. And I guess people on low incomes will look at them and think that that's insane. You know, if I was earning this much money, I would save so much and, you know, they're so lucky and whatever. But as we said, like as you creep up that income escalator, you tend to inflate your lifestyle to match it, you know, because, oh, I'm working harder, I'm earning more, I deserve these, I deserve extra holiday, I deserve, you know, a nicer car and all the rest of it. So it tends to go hand in hand and you're left working harder but in the same position. So regardless of income, this seems to be how most people tend to operate.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's almost like the frog in the boiling pot of water, and you slowly turn it up each minute, you end up boiling the frog. That's how the saying goes. But same thing, it's like you creep up the income ladder and there's always something you can spend just a little bit more on because you think that you don't quite have exactly what you need to be happy. And the more you creep up that ladder, and it just keeps going and going and going. And
it's so tempting. I mean, it's so tempting, man.
Yeah. And each incremental step seems so small. So
yeah. Seems harmless at the time, doesn't it, you know?
It does, yeah. It's like, oh, what? You're earning $90,000 a year. What's an extra $3,000 couch once every 5 years, you know? Whatever.
You deserve to relax in style, Pat. Come on.
Well, exactly. It's like, what's an extra OLED TV? It's only an extra maybe $2,000 or $3,000, and I'm not going to buy one every year. You multiply that out to all the little bits and pieces in your life. And over courses of time, and, you know, those things go out of date eventually again, and it all just repeats itself and can easily just inflate and inflate and inflate. And it goes on forever.
I just guess it's like a human psychological thing, whereas there's no real limit to what our desires can be. There's no limit to how much we can spend. Doesn't matter how much we're earning, you know.
Yeah.
And how much wealth we have, we can always spend it and, I guess, get rid of it if we want to on something, one thing or another. And that's a bit scary when I think about that. That's kind of scary, you know?
Yeah. Well, they do make products specifically for, like, people that just want to spend money to show off their wealth. They make things like diamond-encrusted iPhones. Like, that's a product that I think exists. And it costs, like, thousands and thousands of dollars. And the only possible explanation for a product like that is someone that wants to show off their wealth. Like there's no other explanation. So no matter how much you earn, you can always spend it.
And this is the thing that explains why so many celebrities and sports stars like earn millions and millions and millions of dollars and end up with absolutely nothing and even end up in debt and on the verge of bankruptcy.
Oh.
Because that's the fact, there's no limit to what you can spend, you know? So you have to admit that our basic desires have been met it's really about questioning our, I guess, questioning how much further we take those desires, and I guess trying to control them in a way, trying to limit them and see the sense behind them. Or otherwise. Yes.
Well, once you start it, I mean, I know it's true for me, it becomes almost a habit. You don't feel the desire to spend money on nonsense anymore. Like, I go out, I buy my groceries, I have no desire to go and get a new pair of shoes every weekend or anything like that. It's turning off that consumer culture in your brain and switching off from the marketing and the hype and all of that business. And it's not nearly as hard as people think. I think once you start doing it, it just becomes easy and you start to see it all in a new light.
Yeah. I think you just have to question, you know, I guess purchases or possible purchases when they come up and think, is this really important? You know, is this going to actually really benefit my life? And as you kind of train yourself to see things in different lights and accumulate different habits, it just becomes effortless over time.
Precisely. And that question, you do ask it and you do actually come up with some of the right answers. You know, it's not always spending less. Sometimes I ask that question and the answer is like, yeah, you know, actually I do want to go out and spend some time with my friends. So I am going to go and have dinner with them and spend money and have a couple of drinks. And that's totally fine as well. But that's that decision-making process in your brain that you go through each time you make a purchase.
You've got to weigh it up, don't you? Because some things are like 100% worth spending money on, but some things just really aren't. And it's just about getting better at deciphering what is worth it and what isn't worth it. Because some people take it too far and they just stay at home all the time and don't go out ever, you know, and they don't even see their friends because they don't want to spend money and whatever. So it can go too far and then they end up unhappy because they're not actually doing things that would add value to their lives because they don't want to spend any money at all.
Yeah, you can't do that. That won't last for 10 or 15 years. Yeah, it won't. I mean, it's the truth.
So I guess to sum that part up, the trick to all this is learning to limit our desires and learning to be satisfied with what we already have, realizing that in Australia, we already have very good lives. I guess most of us that are on this path to financial independence, what we're really seeking is freedom more than anything else. So channeling our energy and our money towards buying or creating more freedom, it's going to be a more beneficial and a healthier focus for us to have.
Yeah, agreed. All right, so let's get into savings rate calculations. So this is, I think, a bit difficult to do in a podcast, but we'll try anyway. Makes a lot more sense visually.
We'll just do a couple of them.
Yeah, we'll do a couple of them. What may not be absolutely clear up to now, I don't know if you're new to the FIRE movement or Dave and I really haven't explained it well yet, is the only thing that matters for how long it takes for you to get to FIRE or early retirement is your savings rate. So no matter how much you earn, no matter how much you spend, if you boil all of that down into this one number, which is your savings rate, that should give you a good idea of how long it'll take you to retire. So savings rate is basically percentage of how much you save over your net income. And so if you manage to save 10% of your net income, which is sort of your typical worker who saves nothing but what's automatically put into superannuation for them, takes some 51 years to get to a traditional retirement. And in fact, that's actually probably really good by today's standards because superannuation wasn't around before. Tell me if my numbers are right, Dave. Was it 1990 or 88
or something? Yeah, 92 or something like that. Yeah, around there.
Yeah. So we still haven't actually had a 51-year time frame in Australia where superannuation has been a thing. So you still are getting a lot of workers who are retiring now who don't really have sufficient superannuation balances to support themselves in retirement. But even if they did happen to save 10% per year for an entire 51-year career, that would still just be enough to retire given their current lifestyle.
Yeah. So what if they actually gave a shit and started saving some more money, Pat? What do you reckon that could be? Let's say they bump up that savings rate and they actually, you know, start questioning some of their spending and maybe optimize their car choice or their housing or something like that. Maybe they can get to saving 30% of their income. That would actually allow them to retire in just 28 years. So already that's almost chopped their working career in half. Just
in half.
Jumping from 10% to 30% of their income.
That's insane. We're talking about what's that? How's my math? 23 years.
Of freedom.
Of freedom. Just by saving an extra 20% of your income.
That's insane.
That is wild. You know, 23 years is a lifetime, you know.
even that would be, if you ask the average person on the street, I think if they were able to retire in, even if it's just 30 years, so that would be starting work at 20 and retiring at 50, they would be over the moon with that, I reckon.
Yeah, 100%.
Because retiring at 50 is still retiring early.
Well, yeah, apparently yeah. So. Yeah. But, you know.
What if we crank it up a notch?
What if we crank it up? What's really, what's 30%? We're the fire crowd here. We're not talking children's numbers. What if we cranked it up to 50%? Well, 50% means that you could stop working in 17 years. 17 years.
And that's, so if we think about that, let's say you went to uni and whatever and you started working properly at age 23, you'd be done by 40. You'd be absolutely yeah. free by 40 and you're probably looking down the barrel at, I don't know, hopefully another 40 or 50 years of freedom, really, for you to spend your life however you please.
Yeah, exactly. That's an entire lifetime for you to get your freedom back if you just cranked up your savings to 50%.
And obviously we can go into detail of how all the different strategies and ways that you can actually bump up your savings rate in the future. We can do whole episodes about that if people want to jump into the strategies there.
Mm.
But what if we go to beast mode, Pat? What if we really crank this shit up? What if we go hardcore?
Well, if you want to go as hardcore as some of the people in the fire community go, or what Dave and I like to call, like, actually giving a shit and putting in a bit of effort. In jest. If you could get your savings rate up to 60%, that's 12 and a half years, and 70%, you've now decreased your working career to less than a decade. That's 8.5 years.
Whereabouts are you sitting, Pat? Because I think we peaked. I mean, I think our highest savings rate was about, I think in the best year, it was like 75% or maybe a bit higher. But I think the average was something like 70 or high 60s or something. Whereabouts are you sitting, or what's your kind of average?
I'm currently sitting at about 70%. Mm. And as a couple, Steph and I, if we put it all together, it'll probably bring it down slightly, maybe 65%. So this whole calculation assumes that you want to continue the same lifestyle you have now as you do after retirement. That is slightly not the case with myself, because after retirement, I want to have children. But we'll have a whole episode on children and the cost of raising kids, I'm sure. But there is a small bump up in cost for that.
It's also worth saying that it also assumes you never earn any money ever again, and you don't get and you don't get super and all the rest of it.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. So there's lots of little, these are very broad brush numbers, aren't they?
Yeah.
But in basic, yeah, you're right. We're around 70%, and that puts our working careers at under 10 years.
That's pretty impressive. I think for most people, I don't want to say most people, but for Aussies earning decent incomes, and if there are a couple and they've got control of their expenses and they're really focused on this path, I think about 10 to 15 years is a fair number for a decent chunk of people who are really, really committed to it. And so that would put them at about, I don't know, 50 or 60% kind of savings rate. So I think are possible for like a dual income household or something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think so too. I do think that people sort of lose their way when they start thinking about, you know, housing costs in the big cities and how that can take a huge proportion of your income. I absolutely think 50% is achievable for a couple of well-off Australians or a dual income household.
And that's a big improvement on 0% or what, 0 to 5%, which is the standard in Western society.
Have you got figures on that?
Well, that's the standard. That's like the rough savings rate of Western society, like the US, Australia. The household savings rate's like 5% or something like that.
5%, Jesus, that's nuts.
I think it's that Bureau of Statistics or the RBA puts out figures like that, but I think it's only rarely, very rarely above 10%. It's usually 0 to 5.
Yeah, see, I could never bring myself to save that little. Like, even when fire wasn't a thing, I could never bring myself to spend my whole paycheck, and I don't even know how that's possible for a lot of people. You know, maybe some people really do have basic expenses that expend their entire paycheck. I definitely grant that, but when I say a lot of people, I'm talking about average good income Australian households. The thought of having, you know, a fortnightly paycheck and spending every dollar of it, it would make me a little sick and uneasy. easy. It's like, I'm putting nothing away. Like, this is unsustainable. I need to be putting something away.
Well, yeah, because otherwise I remember in the early days, for a few weeks, I wasn't saving much because I had a few things come up. And it wasn't for long though, for like the 3 or 4 weeks that I wasn't saving much, I was like, this sucks. Like, I've worked for the whole month and I've got nothing to show for it. You know what I mean? Like, it was depressing. It was like, I'm working just to survive.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
I just like, yeah, you just feel sick. It's just like, what a waste of, like, I'm wasting my life saving. Working and not being able to save anything, or like, what's it all for? You start questioning, what's it all for?
Maybe we're the weirdos.
I think that's a given, mate.
No, yeah, it's so true. If I was living paycheck to paycheck, it would genuinely make me sick. Like, that would be considered an emergency for me. It would make me sick. Even if I wasn't, like, buying stuff on credit and didn't have actual emergencies, I would still consider saving anything less than, say, 25% of my income as an emergency that needs to be sorted out so I could save some money.
Mm, definitely.
But we're letting our inner weirdos come out, Dave.
I'm sure that's going to happen more as this podcast goes along. So as you can see, like, from those numbers, each step upwards in that savings rate makes a big difference in terms of your freedom, and not just by a few months, but by years and years and years.
Yeah. Yes.
So if you want to retire sooner, it seems pretty simple, is learn to live on less of your pay, and you can also try and earn more, as we discussed a little bit earlier. But once I found out this whole savings rate business and how important it is, I found it incredibly motivating, because as mentioned a little bit earlier, it's mostly within our control and the choices that we make, I guess, every day and every year. Was it a bit of a game changer for you, Pat, when you realized how important this savings rate was? And it wasn't just, oh, you know, you invest money and eventually, hopefully, it'll grow to this much and then you can retire. When you realized this percentage mattered so much, do you remember how that made you feel?
Yeah. I definitely swung a bit to the extreme, and I definitely wanted to, like, really wind those dials in and just get, like, as efficient as possible. Like you said, it's just hugely motivating because it is immediately within your control. I knew I could start saving straight away, and I did. I just started seeing where I could save money straight away and getting my spending under control, and really increasing that savings rate, and the money just started flowing in. It's really, and that's hugely motivating, because, like you said, again, you see it building up straight away. There's nothing else needed.
Yeah. All right, so let's talk about, I mean, some people might be listening, but I'd be like, well, yeah, it's all right for you guys because you had decent or high incomes, but what about for me? I'm on a low income. Or what about just generally for low income earners? Is any of this possible, or is it just a dream? Is it just only for, you know, middle class and high income Australians? What do you reckon, Pat?
Yeah, look, I definitely think that it's definitely still possible. Going to grant straight away that it's much tougher. You don't have that really high income just catapulting you forward. But in a lot of ways, when you're a low income earner, there's savings just becomes that much more important, because you don't have that extra high income to do what it does for anyone on a much better income, which is catapulting them forward.
I guess it's one of these issues that tends to divide people again. But I guess if we look at a few numbers, the median full-time wage in Australia is about $75,000 per year. And that's actually, that's from the ABS statistics. And that's, I'd say that's pretty good, man. Like, that's pretty good. Come on. and now we have the highest minimum wage in Australia at the moment in the world.
What is it? Do you know? I know I looked at it last year or something, but
just been increased again. I think it's low 40,000s per year.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah.
So it's like 20 something per hour now, because it's had some decent increases in the last couple of years.
Yeah.
So obviously the first argument back is like, yeah, well, housing is expensive in Australia, so our wages should be higher. But got to remember that, like, renting hasn't been growing at the same, like, the cost of renting hasn't been growing at the same pace as the cost of buying a house or the price of housing. So renting is definitely going to be a better option in most cases if you are on a low income. I consider anyone on a low income, if they're earning, this is just random numbers, less than 50 grand a year.
Yeah.
That would be a low income in my book.
Yeah, I think.
And if
I think so. Is that for like a single or for a family or?
Oh, if you're working full time and earning less than that, that's just what I'm thinking in my head.
Yeah, okay.
But if you put it another way, if you're not working full time right now, then in a way, you're kind of semi-retired already.
you might have more freedom than I am.
Yeah, well, you might have a family situation or whatever, but you do, you know, you have more freedom than some other people, so you can look at it in a different lens. So if you're in that position where you're not currently working full time, you can manage any level of saving and investing, then your free time will actually increase from there.
Absolutely.
So the thing is, I guess low income earners do have it harder. We're not trying to say that they should be able to save 70% of their income or anything like that. We know it's going to be harder. We're not trying to sugarcoat it, but we're just saying that it is still possible. And being on a lower income, you just might have to get a little bit more creative, especially around housing and those big costs like car costs and all the rest of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And also should bring up here, it's like, yeah, if you don't have full-time work and you want to find full-time work, then that's obviously a clear step that you need to take if you want to increase your income. And by the same token, as I was saying before, I don't know very many people that are on, you know, median or high incomes that do even a normal working week. This is purely anecdotal, of course, but a lot of the people I meet that are sort of on decent incomes are doing much, much longer hours, you know, 9, 10 hours a day, 11 hours a day sometimes, working weekends, doing all sorts of overtime, whether it's paid or unpaid, but they have a higher salary to begin with. So it's kind of, I don't know, in their salary, so to speak, even though we're talking about savings rates. Increasing earnings, as we were saying before, is a path you can definitely take if you're not on full-time work at the moment. And I don't want to play down how difficult that may be for some people, because I don't have a terrible amount of experience in that field, I'll say.
I think one advantage, if you are on a lower income, you're presumably good at living on less money than, say, your peers who may be on more higher incomes than you are. So I guess the trick there is, if you can increase your earnings even by a bit and you can keep your lifestyle the same, you're able to increase your savings rate, where your peers might be used to that high income already and they're already getting rid of most of it, you know, on their lifestyle. Yeah. But if you've managed to live on a low income already, you almost have an advantage when the time comes and you are able to earn more.
Yeah, 100%.
So some options to improve your, I guess, improve your savings rate if you are in this low income bracket would be, if you're single especially, is to share housing. I mean, I did this at the start of my journey for a couple of years until I met my now partner, and that helped me save quite a lot, you know, because I was just renting with a few other guys, and once you break the costs up between a few people, that's very minimal for pretty decent housing.
Yeah, and I was doing that every year up until this year. So this is actually my first year where I'm not in a share house, and I'm 32 this year.
That's impressive, man. That's a long time.
Well, yeah, exactly. So, I mean, all this, people sort of balk at the idea of share housing. Oh, I'm too old for that. It's like, oh, you know, you choose the lifestyle, you choose the costs, so to speak.
That's a good way to put
it. Yeah, I mean, you can't simultaneously complain about, oh, I don't earn enough, while you're, you know, renting a 3-bed house to yourself.
Yeah. So. Well, that's all right. I mean, well, what else can they do? They can, low-income earners can try and live in a location that allows them to be car-free. Mm. They can bike more places. They can walk. They can use public transport. That'll save tons on car costs. For their food, obviously, they won't be going out to eat all the time. There'll be mostly home-cooked food. I guess their leisure time can be spent like learning and doing productive hobbies, which may even earn them some extra income.
Yeah. 100%. And I think I've mentioned this before, but if you are genuinely on a low income, then I find, maybe you can tell me if I'm wrong here, low income jobs don't tend to be concentrated in high cost of living areas. Like, there are low income jobs in high cost of living areas, but if you're like working at a supermarket or something on a minimum wage, then there's zero reason for you to be living in the middle of Sydney. Like, you should get the hell out of Sydney and get that same low income job where it's much lower cost of living. And this is the same for all sorts of low income jobs. It's like, if you're doing anything that earns you $50,000 a year, chances are you can do that same thing in a low cost of living area. So get the hell out of Sydney. The only reason to be in Sydney is because you're earning a high income in Sydney. And if you're not earning that high income, then the cost of accommodation here is just a waste of money for you.
So you're saying I shouldn't be living in a beachside apartment and just working at the local cafe there?
Precisely. No, yeah, exactly. As another example, if you're working at a cafe, then, you know, you don't need to live in the eastern suburbs of Sydney. You know, there are cafes all over the country which you can work at.
And I guess if we think of like a traditionally low-ish paying type jobs, it might be like a factory job or something like that. Those tend to be more in the suburbs.
Mm.
You know, those industrial areas tend to be more not concentrated towards the city. So
yeah,
you'll be living further away from the city, which is, you know, usually cheaper than living closer to the city.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. And, you know, you're more likely to be able to find accommodation that's a short distance to work instead of living across the other side of the city, which is insanity.
Yeah. I mean, there's a million ways we can live, like, regardless of our income, that we can still live, have a good quality of life while lowering our spending at the same time. So maybe we can, like, in the future, maybe we can combine a bunch of savings ideas into a separate show by itself if people are interested in that. Maybe let us know. Maybe let us know if you want us to do, like, whole shows dedicated to different, I guess, different tips and ideas for increasing your savings rate.
Yeah. I think that's all we got to cover. You got any closing thoughts on this topic?
I think that's pretty much it, man. Like, obviously this is totally biased by our own experiences and our own situations, but we're clearly massive fans of saving, and we definitely lean towards spending your energy and you're having your focus in that area, but for good reason. You know, like, as we said, over a period of like 10 years, it has the majority of your progress will come from saving rather than investing. And so I hope we've made that a little bit clearer today. And it's definitely made all the difference to both of our lives and our level of freedom, with, obviously, I've already retired and Pat's soon to be retired.
Yeah, a few years away, I'd say. Depends on how things go, but I'm definitely well on my way there. And I agree with you. It's all been saving so far.
Yeah.
So the investing has been great, but it has definitely not brought in the majority of the money that's now in my nest egg.
Yeah. So the last point I would make is that if you're going to put your effort into something, make it your savings rate, not working harder to try and increase the return of your investments. Because with saving, the payoff is guaranteed, it's more controllable, and it's repeatable. Whereas with your investments, you might be taking extra risk or relying on a little bit of extra luck. You know, with saving, there's no luck required.
Well, as we'll get into in future episodes, in general, increasing the complexity or doing more work with your investments will probably make them perform worse.
Yeah. And that's counterintuitive as well.
That's very counterintuitive. All right. So I think that's it for our savings rate. Maybe we should get into our second listener question. What do you think, Dave?
All right, sounds good. All right, so this question, it's an interesting one and it's a little bit hard to answer, but we'll see how we go. So here it is.
Yep.
I'm determined to reach FIRE, but my wife is more of a spender than I am. I've explained to her how FIRE works, but she still wants to have all the finer things in life. So how can I convince her that we already have enough and to get on board with FIRE? Ooh, what do you reckon, Pat?
Ooh. So, first of all, I'll just probably say, do not nag your partner into FIRE. Never gonna work, gonna ruin your relationship, ruin your marriage. You cannot nag someone into doing something they don't want to do. And I think, very importantly, something I feel is very important, both partners need to feel like they have financial autonomy. For a sort of successful relationship, one partner can't be sort of dictating to the other partner what they can spend, what they can do with their money. Both partners in the relationship need to have a say. And so this just goes back to, you can't try and nag them into something or get angry or any of that business. It's going to be just a path to complete failure. So though in my experience, and I think in your experience too, Dave, we got extremely lucky with our partners in that they're not huge spenders. They've got the same mindset. They want to save as well and reach the same goal. If you don't happen to find yourself in that situation and you've got a partner that does want to spend more, all I can say is try and lead by example, completely leave them to all of their own financial decisions. Don't question them on what they're buying. Don't do any of that business, because that's just going to lead to resentment and a very toxic relationship, I'll say. So lead by example. If it's really bothering you, then perhaps just somehow try and split the money up into necessities and play money. So all the necessities in your household are covered by both of your incomes, or if one of you are working, then the money that's coming into the household. And then with the play money, each of you gets a certain amount of money to spend on whatever they want, and you can then just save the remainder. And I think that's probably a much fairer way to do it, one that promotes cooperation within the relationship to achieve greater goals in life, but also leaves everyone with their own financial autonomy to do what they want.
That's a good point. So if you wanted to open up the conversation with her, I guess you could ask her what her, like, how she sees the future panning out for you guys and what her goals are or whatever, because she might see things differently from you and I guess have a different vision of the future than you. So maybe dig a little bit deeper into, like, does she think that having this extra stuff or the extra whatever it is, the finer things in life, is she expecting that to make you guys, like, happier than now? Or is she unhappy now? Or, you know, maybe there's something else going on there. So just find out the drivers of what she thinks about the future for you guys. That'll just help you understand where she's coming from. And even having the conversation, it might get her to, I guess, think about things a little bit more, because she's going to be sharing it with you. So it might prompt a rethink there. But maybe she doesn't care about retiring early or being financially secure at all. So what can you do in that situation? Well, maybe you can explain how important it is to you. And if that's the case, she should hopefully understand that that is important to you. And then maybe you can look at doing something like Pat said, where you almost separate the money and come to some sort of arrangement where hopefully you can still build up enough investments to cover maybe your part of the spending, which allows you to retire early, but she gets to keep working and spending on what she likes. Like, it sounds a little bit unusual, but I think it can maybe work for some people, because you can, you're both kind of working on what each other wants at the same time, even though you have different goals. It's still possible, but it might take a little bit of extra effort in working out and having those types of conversations.
Yeah, I suppose where this whole thing gets a bit more difficult is if one partner's working and the other one's taking care of the children. And not to say that taking care of the children isn't working, and I don't want this to get into that sort of debate. But maybe if you feel really strongly about it and your wife is at home taking care of the children, maybe you can offer to be the stay-at-home dad and let her go to work or do something like that. And that way, everyone sort of gets to experience the other person's, you know, what they have to go through on a day-to-day basis. Because I suppose it can be a bit difficult to empathize with what your partner's going through day to day if you don't get to experience it day to day. Whether that be being in full-time employment and going to work every morning and not having the sort of lifestyle you want, or whether that be, you're at home all day and you just want to, you know, have some fun, get out of the house, not always be inside, stuck inside with the children all the time, getting baby brain. It is difficult, but I suppose you'd hope that there's enough, you know, empathy and love in the relationship that you can come to an agreement which both makes you both happy. And that's important too. You shouldn't come into this goal of yours thinking that you need to convince her of your way, because then you're setting yourself up for failure straight away, because it's not about convincing someone that your way is the right way and then stopping at nothing to do that. It's trying to understand where they're coming from as well and what they want, and then finding a compromise which works for both of you. So that's a wrap. What do you think, Dave?
That's it, mate. That's it. All right, that's it for today. Thanks for listening. Next time, we'll be starting to dive into the juicy topic of investing, so stay tuned for that. If you enjoyed this show, either subscribe or share it with a friend. We really appreciate it. And if you have a question that you want answered on the show, you can email us at fireandchillpod@gmail.com. You can find the show notes and the links to stuff we mentioned on the show. You can find that at our blogs, strongmoneyaustralia.com and lifelongshuffle.com. We'll see you next time.